Over the last 4 years, Americans have heard a lot about Russia's interference in our elections. But today's guest says we haven't heard the whole story. Not about the Cold War, not about 2016, and not about 2020. He's David Shimer, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Joining me as he does every week is my great friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week we talk about big issues with great guests, storytellers, novelists, historians, and more to make sense of the big stories shaping the United States today. This week we're joined by David Shimer, a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Institute for Scholars and Yale University, and the author of a new book, Rigged: America, Russia, and 100 Years of Covert Electoral Interference. David, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, I want to say, first of all, congratulations on this book. It is really a compelling read, and it is full of a history that I think most Americans are unaware of. We want to get into it at length, but give us sort of that 30,000-foot overview of the book.
Sure. So I wrote this book, Rigged, because I was rather alarmed that after Russian interference in the 2016 election, so many commentators, so many politicians talked about Russia's operation as if it were unprecedented, which to me was not only wrong, but dangerous, because if something's treated as unprecedented, that means there's no history behind it. It means there's no way to contextualize what's happening and therefore to construct a more informed response to this very serious threat. So what I did here is I restored history to the subject of covert electoral interference, to what came before Russia's 2016 operation. I show in my book how the Soviet Union and the United States interfered in elections during the Cold War, how Russia is interfering in elections all over the world today, and only then do I examine Russia's 2016 operation as sort of the latest chapter in this very old story, which I believe is how it should be told, and I believe is really the only way to understand what actually occurred to America in 2016 and how we should be moving forward toward defending our sovereignty in future elections.
So when you mentioned sort of the Cold War era, you note rightly that the United States was not always the victim in covert electoral interference, but actually a user of that tool. Talk to us about one or two of those cases where the United States was actually intervening in foreign elections.
Sure. So, and that is something that is a matter of the historical record, that the CIA has a storied history of interfering in elections overseas. In fact, after the Soviet Union aggressively interfered in Eastern European elections in the immediate post-World War II period, in Poland, East Germany, and Hungary, the next battleground of election interference was Italy, where the Harry Truman administration judged that the Soviets were targeting the Italian election of 1948 to try to get the communists into power. And Truman then decided to authorize the CIA formally for the first time to engage in covert action in order to interfere in the Italian election. So as it turns out, the starting point of CIA covert action was actually electoral interference. And in Italy, the CIA executed a sprawling operation involving funding the centrist Christian Democratic Party, involving orchestrating propaganda campaigns, involving running what one official put to me as a scare campaign, involving spreading disinformation and other forms of propaganda to frighten voters into either turning out or voting against the communists. And after the Christian Democrats won that election, it was the perception inside the agency that the CIA had made the difference. And that then gave way to an era of covert electoral interference in which the KGB and CIA were going toe-to-toe. And as the CIA's chief internal historian put it to me, the CIA interfered in, quote, many, many elections from Chile and Guyana to El Salvador and Japan in order to promote the parties that aligned with our foreign policy at the time, which was to defeat leftist candidates at the ballot box.
So looking at today, where else is Russia interfering with elections? First question, and second question, what is Russia's objectives? I'm guessing it varies country by country, but maybe you can give an overview of where else and why.
So I would say that Russia's foreign policy has evolved from spreading communism to tearing down democracy. It has evolved from engaging in an ideological struggle to a power struggle, which basically just means that the weaker every other country is, the stronger Russia is, which basically means that to divide democracies from within and one another lifts up Russia and gives Russia new opportunities for influence, which is why you've seen Russia supporting authoritarian-minded, divisive candidates and causes around the world. Ukraine has been a real testing ground of Russia's new digital methods. Its 2014 election was put under siege. I spent time in Kiev interviewing officials involved in that election, and they described tools and tactics that Russia deployed against them that were more or less identical in many ways to what was deployed against the United States 2 years later. But they've also targeted elections in France. There are signs of interference in the United Kingdom. All over Europe, I interviewed the president of Montenegro, whose election was put under siege. He was even attempted a coup against, orchestrated by Russian military intelligence. I also interviewed the president of Colombia, who said that he received warnings of Russian interference across his social media channels, or the channels of his country in the lead up to a Colombian election in 2018. So this is a global strategy that Russia is executing, in order to advance its interests, to increase its relative power from its perspective, and to decrease America's, both by attacking America, but also by attacking America's allies.
So
So.
what happened in 2016 in the United States? We certainly have read a lot about that. There's been some controversy. Some people don't believe it. Many people do, correctly as they should. But you went into great detail in your book. So maybe you can give us more detail on what exactly happened here 4 years ago.
So I try to really tell that story without politics, which I think is really important to really just get at the heart of this threat, this issue. And I interviewed more than 130 officials, 8 former CIA directors, and 26 former advisors to President Obama to really recreate that story from the inside. And what I found at the most basic level is that Russia did 3 things to America. Well, its objective was to sow discord and to help one candidate and hurt another. But its 3 actual ways of accomplishing that were to A, systemically penetrate and probe our voting systems and election infrastructure, and Russian military intelligence did that. The second thing they did was they stole and released sensitive Democratic Party emails, the DNC and John Podesta emails, which were then leaked through WikiLeaks, which was in effect a Russian cutout. And that was again done by Russian military intelligence. And the third aspect of Russia's operation was to use social media to spread massive amounts of propaganda that ultimately ended up reaching over 100 million Americans who did not realize that the content they were seeing originated from a troll farm in St. Petersburg. That was the operation. I would also argue that there were each of those 3 vectors marked a direct continuation of the past. None of them were entirely original, but each of them was an extension of what had come before, and in some cases marked an innovation. And the melding of those 3 facets, those 3 vectors, put the Obama administration in a very difficult position, which I can talk about as to how to respond, when to respond to Russia's operation, and to what degree to inform the American people about what was happening in real time.
So, David, you were pretty pointed in your criticism of the Obama administration's response, essentially that they got the first two of those threats, at least they tried to respond, but they missed the social media aspect of it. Yeah, can you talk to us a little bit about what the Obama administration did in response in 2016?
So the only way to understand the Obama administration's response to Russia's operation that I found is to break it up into kind of 2 tracks, because for every operation to interfere covertly in an election, there can either be efforts to manipulate public opinion or efforts to manipulate actual ballots. And Russia was running on those 2 tracks at the same time. The social media aspect of its operation and the emails had to do with manipulating American voters, and the penetration of our election systems had to do with the potential to impact actual ballots, to manipulate those systems. And in the summer and fall of 2016, the Obama administration, as you said, looked over, missed. the social media aspect of Russia's operation, but did know that Russia was responsible for the hack and release of those emails. But they also knew that Russian military intelligence was aggressively targeting our election infrastructure. And it was decided inside the administration that the priority, the imperative should be to prevent Russia from escalating its operation towards sabotaging our actual voting systems. That was why President Obama made each of the moves he made in the summer and fall around warning Vladimir Putin to stand down, around getting the DHS to support states and shoring up their systems, around trying to get congressional leaders to issue a robust statement about the security of election systems. And on Election Day itself, as I reveal in my book, having the White House and DHS running secret crisis teams bracing for a Russian cyber attack against our election infrastructure. John Brennan told me that Russia had the capability to alter the voter data and actual vote tallies of U.S. citizens. Based on all available evidence, Russia did not execute upon that capability. But all the while, Russia was manipulating tens of millions of Americans with propaganda through those that other track that I mentioned, and experienced no consequences for doing so until after Election Day, despite the urging of some in the Obama administration to hit Russia sooner in order to deter further interference in the election.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard four times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my friend G. Wayne Miller. He's an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of 17 books. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is David Shimer, a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Institute and Yale University, who's the author of a remarkable new book, Rigged: America, Russia, and 100 Years of Covert Electoral Interference. David is on Twitter, too, at David A. Shimer. That's DavidAShimer. To follow up on that very quickly, what led to the, what was the driving force of the reticence? I think it sounds like it was at President Obama's feet, to not respond more forcefully before Election Day.
So I there were a couple of factors, but the one that really came out most strongly in the interviews I did was concerns around escalation, around the idea that if President Obama had hit Russia in August with, let's say, economic or cyber penalties, as had been urged by some in his administration, most notably the Russia experts, that Russia could have then responded not by backing down, but by doubling down, by saying, if you hit us, then we're going to hit you back harder. We're going to escalate toward manipulating your infrastructure. And for the Obama team, that was a, quote, red line that they wanted to prevent Russia from crossing, that they thought could get at the very legitimacy of the election if, say, Russia caused chaos at certain polling places as voting was unfolding. And this is also in the backdrop, of course, of one major party candidate saying the election would be rigged, and it being perhaps assumed, as Jim Clapper and Jay Johnson acknowledged in interviews, that the other candidate was going to win anyway. So given that it seemed as though Donald Trump would say the vote was rigged in defeat, Obama wanted the election to seem as unrigged as possible. And in doing so, the imperative was to prevent Russia from manipulating infrastructure and making the vote appear rigged. And in that sense, whether Russia was, you know, releasing some emails, it didn't really seem to matter much in the grand scheme of things. What really mattered from the perspective of the White House at the time was the exposure of our actual systems.
So the election infrastructure in the United States is a sprawling, massive, diverse, complex system. It varies city by city, town by town, state by state. Does Russia have the ability to actually manipulate? It seems to me they would have to go at many different targets, or perhaps they would only go at a few. Does the technology exist to actually be able to do that, is what I'm asking.
So I can speak to what the state of play was in 2016, and also the fact that there's been work done to try to shore up our system since then. But you're right, because of the decentralized nature of our election administration, because each state controls their system, we're only as strong as our weakest link. If one state is choosing to use exposed or insecure systems, therefore we're vulnerable. So DHS can offer to help, the FBI can offer to help, but states have to open their doors. They have to say, you're therefore able to do your work to secure our systems, because that's just the way that our country is structured. And in 2016, there were many states that did accept federal help, but there were also many states that didn't, that said, these are our systems, leave us alone. You're trying to hijack our sovereignty or our independence from Washington, and you yourself are trying to you know, have some sort of power grab over the administration of elections. And so the understanding and intelligence in 16 was that Russia was inside certain systems. The White House cybersecurity coordinator told me that every day he was receiving reports of Russian intrusions and scanning of election systems across the country. He came to conclude that Russia was targeting and probing all 50 states. Even a few days before the election itself, that cybersecurity coordinator sent a message to his counterpart in Russia that he recalled to me, where he said to cease and desist their scanning and penetrating of our voter registration databases. And again, on election day, it was a crisis posture, high alert, in the words of one high-ranking Homeland Security official, bracing for Russia to either affect the voting record or voting systems to sabotage the legitimacy of the election itself, not to flip the outcome. I don't think anyone thought that Russia had the capability to change millions of ballots, but I don't think that was what the game was either. I think the worry was that Russia was seeking to undermine democracy itself, which is the Russian objective, by just tampering with one system here or another system there in a key precinct, in one state or another, in order, in a detectable but anonymous way, that would cause the entire country to say, wait, was this election secure? Is there actually something behind the allegation that it wasn't, that it was rigged? And I think that was the concern in 16, based on what President Obama's advisors recalled to me for my book.
So here we are in 2020. How are we? We're taping this in, and we should note, we're taping this in the second week of September. Election day is just a little bit more than 2 months away as we record this. How are we doing when we look at the threats in this cycle? And are we seeing the same sort of Russian activities?
So it's now a fact, or not, I shouldn't say a fact, but the U.S. intelligence community has confirmed that Russia is interfering actively in the 2020 election. We've seen Facebook and Twitter take down a covert Russian network of accounts. And something important that history reminds us is that what we see in real time is often the tip of the iceberg. So if there's already a network of Russian accounts taken down, that suggests there will be many more that will be discovered over time. It's not as though we're able to detect everything all at once involving these sorts of covert operations. And we also know that there is now a president who has solicited, rather than sought to deter, foreign interference in our elections, which is a marked departure from 2016. We also know that there's a pandemic ongoing that will sow massive amounts of doubt about the stability of our voting process, regardless of what Russia does, which is important because the Russian tradition is to take advantage of pre-existing weaknesses and vulnerabilities. And in that sense, our election administration is as vulnerable as ever because there's so much doubt about it. But we also know that we've had 4 years for our federal agencies and states to both shore up their systems and to spread awareness about this threat. So I think that there's some ways in which we're more prepared than we were 4 years ago, but there are other ways in which we're more vulnerable. And the question now is, between now and election day, how far Russia will choose to go in seeking to manipulate voters, public opinion along that first track, and whether Russia will seek to escalate toward impacting our actual election systems, which would be along that second track, in order to cause chaos in the actual process of holding an election.
So I used the word sprawling earlier to talk about our election infrastructure, and I think that would also apply to social media, Facebook and Twitter in particular, because there are so many millions of users. Talk about efforts that Facebook and Twitter in particular have made, could make, and haven't made to thwart, for lack of a better word, to thwart Russian interference or Russian disinformation.
So I think you've seen a couple of positive developments along the technological route. You've seen increased public-private cooperation. The takedown that I mentioned by Facebook and Twitter was based off of an FBI tip-off. So that's the kind of communication that's really essential to detecting these sorts of operations. You've seen, I think, increased transparency about takedowns in general. What you haven't seen is any sort of regulation on the part of the Congress, which I think is a shame, given that there's been 4 years now to try to develop some sort of oversight over these companies in a legal sense. But I also think we need to be clear-eyed about the fact that there is no way, based on anyone I interviewed, that these social media companies can completely stop these sorts of operations, that they can get Russian interference, foreign interference across their platforms to zero. I think they can try to manage this problem. I think they could try to take down these networks as quickly as possible. But something history instructs is that these operations are not new, but that also means they're not going away. To be an open society means that you're vulnerable to subversion, that you're vulnerable to penetration, whether that's across radio, television, news platforms, or now social media. This has always been a feature of democratic systems. The digital sphere has just opened up new opportunities to reach the public in a covert but wide-reaching way. And now it's on us to play catch up, to figure out how to get this problem as under control as possible, while also not being fatalistic about its implications for democracy, because just because Russia is able to have these networks running doesn't mean we're doomed. Many democracies that were interfered in decades ago remain democracies today. It just falls on us as citizens, and it falls on our public officials to care enough to respond to this threat and to keep our democracy functioning despite the existence of foreign adversaries who want to do us harm.
How do you grade the American public's response to this narrative? I mean, we've been sort of inundated with these reports since 2016. There have been five volumes now of really sort of remarkable reporting from the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. There's the Mueller report. There's a whole host of journalistic and scholarly treatments on this issue. But a large segment of the public still remains skeptical. What do you say to them?
So, I mean, what I'd say to the public is that this is not a political issue. It has been made to be political because of the charged nature of our times. But something that, again, history shows us is that it is long lasting, it's not a myth, and it is ongoing. Where in the Cold War in 1960 and 1968, the Soviet Union sought to destroy the candidacies of Richard Nixon, a Republican. In 1976 and 1984, they sought again to destroy the candidacy of a Republican, Ronald Reagan. In 2016 and now, it just so happens that Russia wants to help a Republican, but this isn't about any one political party. This is about advancing Russia's interests, which are to choose our leaders for us, to sabotage our democracy, and to undermine the viability of open elections as a viable form of governance, and that should offend all Americans, regardless of their party loyalties.
So what would you advise a concerned citizen? And I would make the argument that during the pandemic, and certainly during the last several months with the resurgence and the growing power of the Black Lives Movement and related movements, that there are a lot of concerned people, citizens who want to do something, who want to see change. And beyond just voting, what would you advise the average citizen who is concerned about what we're seeing here with what we've been discussing in terms of Russian interference?
So I think beyond voting, for citizens, it's about recognizing that the purpose of these operations is to manipulate them. So they need to be more discerning, more mindful, and more proactive in finding and absorbing facts, good information that's been vetted, that's been fact-checked, rather than chasing sensationalist tweets or unverified accounts. Because by opening yourself up to this sprawling information environment you're in, you often consume poor and inflammatory propaganda, whether that be domestic or foreign-based. I also think it's about putting pressure on whether it be congressional lawmakers, social media companies, or reporters, frankly, to send in public comments saying that these operations should be covered in a robust, but also, you know, down the middle way. And that if, let's say, hacked documents were to be released again, I mean, there's a very instructive story in France, where the French election in 2017, you saw the release of emails of one political campaign, the Macron campaign, and the media, the public, politicians, more or less everybody kind of said, wait, we just saw this happen to the United States. We saw them get played. We don't want to be played too. And those emails, for various reasons, got very little coverage. So I think there's a degree of built-in gullibility here that we as Americans need to overcome. We need to recognize that this is a threat that exists, and we need to try to fortify our democracy against it, because this is not a threat, again, to any one candidate. It's a threat to the functioning of our political system. And so we all need to be a part. We all need to be party to that effort to try to fortify our democracy. And there are various ways, more specifically, that I could talk about as to how to do that in the future. But it starts with broad buy-in from the public and with broad awareness about what Russia is seeking to achieve.
Well, let's go a little deeper on that. We've got just a couple of minutes left here, but what more should we be doing as a society?
So in my opinion, this has to be both domestic and foreign policy based. You can't just do one or the other. Where if Russia is seeking to tear down our democracy, we need to renew our democracy. We need to renew ourselves at home, first and foremost, by securing our infrastructure, and also by doing those two things I talked about with social media companies and reporters. With social media companies, having transparency, having accountability, having regulation, and having private-public cooperation. With reporters, expecting that reporters will cover both the source of stolen documents as well as their contents, have the government attribute anonymous releases as quickly as possible to give journalists as well as the public as much information as possible as those documents are circulating about who's trying to influence us and why, and also for citizens, again, to be mindful about the content they're absorbing. But beyond that, Russia's tactics will continue to evolve. It's not just going to be what they did in 2016. History didn't stop 4 years ago. So therefore, we need to get at what Russia's really exploiting, which is the division and the decaying nature of many of our democratic structures, by reinvesting in ourselves, in local media, in education, in basic domestic priorities that will make us less vulnerable to this type of political subversion. But in conjunction with that, we also need to be renewing our leadership abroad. We should be working with the democracies of the world who are also under siege in both detecting and deterring these types of operations. And we should be communicating very clearly to Russia and any fellow travelers that if you attack our elections covertly, we will hit you back, and the cost will outweigh the perceived benefits of such operations. And I believe that if you do those two things at once, if you both renew yourself at home while also punishing bad actors abroad, it won't solve the problem, because again, I don't view this as a solvable problem, but it will put us in a much, much better position than we are in now, where it's basically open season on democratic elections around the world, including ours.
David Scheimer, the book is Rigged. Thank you so much for being with us. This is an extraordinary book, essential reading for this moment in our democracy. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square. Thank you.